today on Rockin' the Suburbs.
Slang, something or someone very striking or exceptional.
Everyone, and welcome to Rockin' the Suburbs. My name is Patrick Foster. On behalf of Jim Linehan, I want to welcome you to another episode of our music podcast. Today, we're going to continue our conversation about Lollapalooza, mainly focusing on the first tour in 1991. And I want to thank, and on behalf of Jim as well, thank John Geddes very much, our old friend John. We've known him for a long time, and great to have his insights and thoughts, and he has the t-shirt. That's right. He still has the Lollapalooza 1991 t-shirt. That thing is probably worth a ton on eBay. But without further ado, let's jump right back into our conversation. When we hit the tape here on this one, I'm going to be rambling about something or other. Imagine that. Here we go. Lollapalooza Day 2 on Rockin' the Suburbs.
I think for the American music scene at the time, to be able to have those things coexist and be just as important as one or the other, right? There's no, you know, no thing that outweighs the other. All these kinds of music are on the same level. And, you know, that's another groundbreaking thing I think about when they did this tour. And it's funny, the other day I was doing my radio show on Rocking the Suburbs Radio, and it was the birthday of Judy Garland, a.k.a. Frances Gumm. And when they first started out, they were the Gumm sisters, and they were on this vaudeville tour. And I was thinking, because, you know, we were going to do this Lollapalooza, I'm like, how is this kind of not like Lollapalooza? There's like right. A juggler, you know, and a guy playing like water glasses, and then the Gumm sisters and like all this weird.
Yeah.
So in that way, you know, Perry Farrell maybe tapped into the American history subconscious somehow to like kind of a minstrel show in some ways.
Well, that's a good point. I mean, he did want it to be more than just music, right? There were other aspects to this festival atmosphere as well, right?
Yeah, they did it, you know, and this is a later evolution of the festival, but didn't they have like the Jim Rose traveling circus or something like that? Like that would do like,
well, like really weird, like body disfigurement sort of acts and things like that.
Yes.
Yeah. I don't know. that might be a little too much for even me, but I want to get back to, you know, what you and John were saying too, about the diversity of the bill, but not just that. I mentioned, my son, Patrick, was watching this documentary with me.
Mm-hmm.
And so as a young person today who grew up in a totally different music environment than we did, right? Not having to do what I just mentioned, having to like search out, you know, search, hunt, work for the music I liked, but it all kind of just comes to him now, right? You know what I mean?
Right.
Yeah.
He had no real concept, and I had to like stop and explain to him. He had no real concept of alternative. Like, it just doesn't exist in his world. You know what I mean?
Really?
And I had to kind of explain, like, well, mainstream was like, that was the stuff you heard on the radio, and alternative was other.
Right.
Right. And you, like I said, you had to like be a little bit more in the know to get that music. And what Lollapalooza 91 showed was that there was a bigger market for that than many of the people in the music industry anticipated, right? Or understood.
Interesting. Yeah.
But I'm curious what you think about that. Like, have we sort of lost this idea of like, is there even today like mainstream versus alternative? Like is that sort of an outdated concept, right?
Hmm.
I think you have to be kind of really out there to be considered alternative, at least in by my definition, because I think everything is fairly mainstream. I think there's still bands experimenting, and I think there's still very interesting music out there. And I think we have exposure to it, but I think to your point that you just made about like the music comes to us, you don't have to seek it out. I remember when, you know, college radio was a thing, like,
right.
Oh man, who's big on college radio? And now college radio is just like, you know, 102.4 FM or whatever. You know, it's like something you can easily, you can easily access, and you're going to hear that song on mainstream radio within 2 weeks if it's popular. So, I think the music industry has changed considerably as well. So if a song, I mean, I don't know what a good example is, but like if a Black Keys song hits big and it gets popular among like a certain, college demographic or whatever, that song's going to blow up and it's going to be a pop mainstream song within probably 2, 3 months. So
Yeah.
it's a different dynamic on the way that songs are spread now too.
Yeah, if you get on a Spotify playlist,
Right.
then
Yeah.
suddenly it can change your whole career.
I just think people today, and I think young people in particular are much more accepting, It's like
Yeah.
you could listen to like you could be talking with somebody an 18-year-old or whatever and be like, and they could have some taste that's really out there, like, "Oh, I'm listening to some band that, like zither music or something." And it'd be like, "That's cool." You know what I mean? Like nobody would even think anything of it anymore, They're like, "Oh, wow."
Right. Listen to what John was saying too, Jim, and what we were talking about. It Lollapalooza, in many ways, I guess, for me, now that I think about it and try, put it in context and listen to you guys talk about it, it was like, the guy with the really cool eclectic record collection, like he
Right.
was going to spin a little house party in your neighborhood. Like you could go and see like all these different sounds, right? And, oh, it's only like, $30 to get in? Hell yeah. that also signaled the fact that we couldn't get any beer in there.
Wait, you mean what? You mean you couldn't bring it in, or you couldn't afford to buy it, or they didn't sell it?
You couldn't bring anything in there. Were they selling beer? If they were, John, I don't think anybody was drinking it or buying it. Yeah.
Park property was, I think it was NVRPA, Northern Virginia Regional Park Authority, so they didn't sell any alcohol there.
Wow. Okay, now that's
Yeah. It was a straight edge
now Jane's
show,
Addiction might say nothing shocking, but that's shocking to me.
I do recall when they ran out of water, they came back. I want to say around like 3:15, maybe even later than that, at 4 o'clock. And prior to that, you had to buy water. You had to buy, and it was a ridiculous amount of money for back in the day. So people had purchased all the water, and then later in the day, they came back with like massive amounts of pallets of new water, and suddenly every water was free, and everyone was like, "I blew all my money on water in the morning. Like, what was that all about?"
Right.
And suddenly all the water was free. And then that was the year, 91 was the year, I think, of the water bottle showers that littered the stage and the audience.
Yes.
When you look back on like the Jane show late at night, you saw the stage lights and saw all the water bottles flinging around. And then the next year in 92 was the Mudfest with Soundgarden and with Chili Peppers. So One was plastic, one was mud. Pick your poison.
Yeah, and I remember this. I don't know if you, it was where you were, John, but I actually was able to, like I said, dig up that Washington Post review. And apparently on one side, there was a guy from who like ran a pool company or something and had a truck full of like water and he was spraying it over the fence, right? Remember that?
Yeah.
Onto the crowd to like cool them off.
They brought the pumper truck in, yeah, basically.
Yeah, that's right.
That's great. So you mentioned, Patrick, you wanted to see Butthole Surfers.
Yep.
And John wanted to see Jane's Addiction. Were there other bands that maybe, were there other bands on the bill that surprised you once you saw them play?
Nine Inch Nails. They shocked me.
Yep.
I was familiar with Head Like a Hole, which was obviously the big hit they had.
Yeah.
But I remember when they opened up and it was just a punch the crowd in the face version of Terrible Lie. And everybody was just like, what the hell is this? This is incredible. And they did not let off the gas until the very end. And I think they closed with Down In It and Head Like a Hole was the final song. And it was, people just felt out of breath because everybody was just up and down the entire time. It was just an absolute frenzy, but they surprised the hell out of me. But I also go back and sorry, not to steal Patrick's opportunity to answer that, but I mean, if you go back and look at the time, the albums that had just been released by these bands, like Jane's Addiction had just released, I believe, the year prior, Ritual.
Yep.
Susie and the Banshees had just released Superstition. Nine Inch Nails had done Pretty Hate Machine. Ice-T had just released OG Original Gangster. So these were bands that were like hitting their stride or at the top of the with a lot of their music. And, you know, I mean, obviously a lot of those albums now are legendary, but we got to see them live, like almost like, hey, we'll do a rehearsal here in Lollapalooza before we take it on the road ourselves.
Yeah.
So it was just really cool to see the abbreviated sets and what these bands could do. But yeah, for me, it was Nine Inch Nails. They just blew me away.
Living Color also played. I'm remembering that vaguely, remembering Vernon Reid in Living Color. But I'll say, like, I didn't know anything about Jane's Addiction, and they were the last act. And, like, you, when you were at this show, it was like, well, we're not leaving. Like, we don't even know where our car is. There's, like, 15 cars parked inside of it already. We've, like, people's neighborhoods were totally enclosed. There was no way they were ever getting out. Until all the cars cleared. So you were like, I'm here for the whole thing. But Jane's Addiction played last, and I had no idea that they were so musical and fun and, you know, had all these sort of different influences. And I was totally blown away by them. I really was.
That was an amazing show. It really was. I mean, I obviously was a educated Jane's Addiction fan at the time, but seeing them play like 3 days live, 3 days is like a 12-minute song, and I was like, you know, this is going to be boring as hell. It was mesmerizing.
Yeah.
You know, I just go to, I'm a drummer, so I mean, I go to the drum parts at like the 4 minute mark, the 7 minute mark, and then breaking into that last kind of crescendo where the entire song just builds and builds and builds. But seeing that live and seeing the effect on the audience was pretty amazing. I mean, it was certainly not something my band could have done at the time, nor could have ever, but it was really impressive to see an artist, you know, a band like that control an audience that much.
I think Perry Farrell should get all the credit in the world, man. I think,
yeah.
I think Jane, not only was Jane's Addiction, you know, a few years ahead of its time when you see what, you know, kind of broke in the 90s, right? And they were doing it in the late 80s, that, you know, that sound. I also think a massively creative band, and also, you know, for doing this for Lollapalooza like that, I just think it just was a huge impact on, you know, on our generation and turn and then on the music scene and sort of, you know, allowing these artists to grow and reach bigger audiences, you know?
Oh, 100%. Yeah. I mean, the definition that they have on the back of the shirt for Lollapalooza is, slang something or someone very striking or exceptional, and I think that absolutely describes Perry Farrell and what he did with the event. I mean, it was next level for sure.
Nobody was doing that. Nobody was doing anything like that.
Do you remember what you paid for that T-shirt, John?
I want to say I paid $10 for that shirt.
Oh wow!
the only reason it survives is because when I bought it, it was an XL, and that's all they had left in stock. And I was wearing larges at the time. I could probably wear it now, but I put it back before and I was like, you know what? It's too nice. I'm not going to wear it anymore.
No, that's an artifact, man. You know, keep that for sure.
Oh, I wish I was smart enough to buy a T-shirt at that concert. That would have made a lot of sense. Yeah, it really would have. Thanks, everybody, for listening to this episode. We've got one more part of this conversation that I think you're going to really enjoy. We're going to wrap it all up. And I don't know if anything will top the Jim shock of learning that there was no alcohol available at Lollapalooza, but the first gig there was not, which is kind of crazy. It was in a Fairfax County Regional Park, so it wasn't the kind of thing that happened. Again, want to thank John Geddes very much for his insights, and we'll hear more from John tomorrow. And we will wrap up the Lollapalooza conversation. I also want to remind everybody that there's no episode on July 4th for Independence Day. Hope everybody has a safe and fun 4th of July holiday. And then we'll talk to you guys a little bit later in the week, but there's still one more Lollapalooza episode, and we will talk to you guys with that tomorrow.
Really weird, like, body disfigurement.